Veterans Affairs Committee to order. Let the record show it's 1,300 hours plus 10 minutes, 1:10, on Thursday, March 1st, 2012. Present with us today are Co-Chair Representative Thompson, Representative Austerman, Representative Lynn, Representative Miller, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Sadler. Everyone, of course, please kill your BlackBerrys, devices, iPhones, and so forth. Even Vibrate will get us humming in the system. Today's meeting, we have with us Mr. Alex Spector, not Alan, but Alex Spector, Director of the Veterans Affairs Healthcare System in Alaska, and he is here to give us an overview on Alaska VA healthcare system, and I understand he's going to cover quite a wide range of topics in his powerful PowerPoint presentation. For the record, this meeting is being teleconferenced out to the world. However, it is a listen-only presentation, so you can listen, but no comments at this time. And with that, Mr. Spector, please state your name for the record, your affiliation, and start your presentation.
My name is Alex Spector. I'm the director of the Alaska VA healthcare system. And thank you very much for having me here today to kind of bring you up to date on what the federal VA is doing here in Alaska. And I'm glad to see that Verdi Bowen is here, also in the audience, our state Veterans Affairs coordinator that I work very closely with. So I'll go to my presentation, and these are the topics that I want to cover today. Quite a bit of information. I thought these topics would be items that you would be interested in, the demographics of our veterans, kind of basic eligibility for veterans in case you're not aware of who is eligible for care, our scope of services, that clinical services that we do offer, where we offer sites of care, talk about our joint venture relationship with DOD, the 673rd Medical Group in at J-Bear. Talk a little bit about our Alaska Federal Healthcare Partnership. OEF, OIF, and OND are soldiers, and they're returning, and what we're doing for the soldiers that are returning here to Alaska. Eliminating homelessness, our rural health care, and our Care Closer to Home initiative, and then finally, health information exchange here in Alaska and the VA's participation. And I'll kind of look to questions on each of these topics as we go along, rather than waiting to the end, since it's quite a bit of information. So our next slide talks about the demographics of the number of veterans in Alaska, and you well know that the official number that we're using now is 77,351, and that is the highest percentage per population of veterans in the United States. And of those 77,000, 30,022 enrolled in our VA healthcare system. A very high market penetration compared to other states of veterans who are enrolled in our VA healthcare system. And of those 30,000, 16,595 got treatment last year. Not everybody goes to the doctor every year. And that's how many came and actually received treatment from us or we purchased care for. Our slide here shows the distribution of the veteran population, which I thought might be of interest to you. And not surprisingly, our veterans are dispersed just like the general public. If you add Anchorage and Matsu together there, you get half the population in Alaska. Our veterans live in that same area. And then Fairbanks, a higher concentration there. And then it starts to drop off as you go to areas that are further away from the urban centers. But if you look at the percentage of veteran population that are enrolled for care of the veterans, very high percentages, actually, for market penetration, again, much higher than other places in the United States. And I think it's interesting that of all the veterans in the Anchorage Bowl area, 45% of them are enrolled in the VA system. Basic eligibility is another area that there are eight priority groups of eligibility. From the highest priority groups, priority one, which are service-connected veterans, veterans who have a condition that they got while they were in the service, all the way down to priority eight, which are non-service-connected veterans, high-income veterans. And so there are co-payments that are required of some of the non-service-connected veterans. And the co-payments for care are equivalent to Medicare co-payments, approximately. We do bill third-party insurance. Veterans has a third-party insurance. They come to see us, We bill that third-party insurance. We don't receive 100% on the dollar, but last year we collected $18 million, and that $18 million stayed in Alaska, stayed with the Alaska VA healthcare system, and helps us do many of the projects that you're going to hear about. The slide that says see the detailed information in your briefing folder, I think that was left over from another presentation because I don't think you have that that briefing. But with the, combined with the eligibility and the numbers of veterans that have enrolled, we're very popular with veterans, obviously. And our services have grown every year 5 or 6%. And our population has grown every year 5 or 6%. The population of Alaska isn't growing 5 or 6%. So I think what's happening is the word is out that the benefit package is very good for veterans and that we give very good care and respectful care, and that veterans are saying, I signed up. They're saying to their neighbors, you're a veteran. Why don't you go over there and sign up for care also? This is a list of the scope of services. Yes, sir.
Inspector, I'm going to stop you there and ask you, what factors influence or determining who does sign up, which veterans do sign up and which don't in general? What predictors?
Well, I don't think I have any scientific evidence. You know, I have my feelings about it. And I think that your veterans who do not have insurance, private insurance, sign up as a safety net. Our returning veterans are signing up. As you know, more and more veterans are staying in the state rather than once they finish with their deployment, going back to Michigan, back to Mississippi or whatever. I think there may be an effect on with the economy in the lower 48, and it would be interesting to see some studies if that's attracting veterans and others to Alaska because of our economic stability. Now, the further you get away from, again, urban areas or a source of a VA service, the numbers go down as far as who's enrolling. But I'm glad you brought that up because enrollment is the key to all this. You have to get enrolled in order to get the services. And later when we talk about some of the initiatives that we are doing, it's very important it starts with enrollment. And so we're doing a lot of outreach to get more veterans enrolled. Secretary Shinseki was here back in May, and he said to groups that he talked to that there are 8 million veterans, there are 6 million users. How much money does Congress give me to take care of veterans? For 6 million veterans. So it's important to enroll because they're not going to give the VA money for veterans that aren't getting care.
A brief follow-up, I'm going to ask you, what kind of briefing does a soldier airman getting out of the service, mustering out, how much are they told about what's available to them and the benefits of enrolling in the VA?
We attend quite a few sessions of the returning soldiers to explain benefits, to get people signed up early. It takes more than one. Any of you who were servicemen knew that as you got out, the last thing you wanted to do was listen to a lecture from the VA. You want to go home. And so we not only have opportunities prior to discharge, but with this war and our National Guard especially, there's follow-up requirements to be seen at 6 months and 1 year, I think. And we attend each of those sessions when they bring everybody in for those health checks and health reviews. So I was talking about our scope of clinical services that we provide in the healthcare system. We are primarily deliver primary care in our hands-on care that we provide in the Alaska VA healthcare system. And we provide that at several sites that I'm going to show you around Alaska. So primary care in our Muldoon clinic, we also have a home-based primary care program in which a 20-mile radius from our Anchorage facility, we visit veterans, frail veterans in their home. We have about 65 veterans that we go out and take care of them in their home. So here we've gone full circle in healthcare back to buggy days of having the visiting doctor. The families, of course, love it. We have a small lab, radiology, and pharmacy in our building there on Muldoon. Dental service, we do offer dental service. That's one of the services in the VA where the eligibility is very specific, very limited to certain conditions. Social and behavioral health services, our mental health services. We've doubled our mental health staff in the last 5 years because of the returning soldiers and the issues that they have, and I'll show you some information on that. We offer many special mental health services, suicide prevention coordinator, outreach for the returning soldiers, military sexual trauma specialists to deal with that issue you've read about in the newspapers. Our mental health staff is actually integrated into our primary care clinics. So we have a mental health provider in primary care. That's worked out great. As if a primary care provider has a problem, needs a quick consultation with a mental health provider, they're right there next door. If they need a medication adjustment, if somebody comes in there in some sort of mental health crisis, they can be seen right away. Yes, sir.
Got a question, Representative Lynn?
Thank you. On the mental health services and needs, is there any increase in those needs of those folks who came back World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and so on, as compared to Iraq and Afghanistan? Are we getting more of those needs now in these later wars like Iraq and Afghanistan than we did in, say pre-Vietnam? Or are we just identifying needs better than we did before? Are people reporting problems more than they did before?
I think it's a little of everything that you just said. I mean, we are focusing, have been focusing on the returning soldiers. But as you know, this post-traumatic stress disorder that we've identified following Vietnam, Korean War veterans and World War II veterans suffered from that also. But they didn't share.
Shell shock.
Yes.
That was the old term.
Yes. But we are, so as these services are publicized more and as there's more talk in the paper, you do find older veterans now coming in and families bringing their Korean War veterans and saying, my father never talked about this. And as he gets older, he's now talking about it. He never received treatment for this. And I think another aspect of Alaska is, as you know, many, our oldest age group of population is our older veterans. They're an older population. They're not moving out of Alaska like they used to. They're staying here. And so we're seeing an increase and also seeing our older veterans also. In addition to social and behavioral health, our homeless veteran programs, I'm going to talk at length on ending homelessness. It's a priority of Secretary Shinseki, and I'm going to share some information with you in a little while of the many programs that we have in Alaska and what the result is. We do provide limited specialty care in our clinic. We have two surgeons that provide ambulatory surgery. They do any major surgery over at the 673rd Med Group. They're incorporated into the call system over there. We have orthopedic surgery, podiatry. We have contract urology services. So we have some specialty care, and most of it is outpatient care, that ambulatory surgery service that you see there. We have a program coordinated care home telehealth, which is pretty interesting. These are telehealth monitoring devices that are placed in the home of a veteran that will monitor their diabetes, their blood pressure, depression screening, some other activities, and it's in their home. And we have almost 290 of these devices in Alaska, and you certainly can see how that would help us for rural areas. There are some technology challenges with it because it has to be a landline, and in some of our rural areas the landline system isn't very good. But where it's appropriate, we get this for veterans, and of course it then avoids travel of having to come in frequently. We talk about one of our cases in the Pribilofs, where a veteran in the Pribilofs who had been medevaced in two or three times a year into Anchorage had one of these devices, and his problems could be monitored from afar, and the provider at AMC in this case actually made adjustments to his medication, and he stopped being medevaced for the last 3 years. He did pass away recently, But he was because of that technology, he was allowed to pass away in his home out in the Pribilofs rather than having to come to Alaska and come to Anchorage and be hospitalized.
And what's the name of that device?
Home telehealth monitoring.
Home telehealth
HTM.
Monitoring. HTM. Would that be like heart monitors or what?
It does some of that, but it also looks at your A1C for diabetes, takes a sample of your blood. It monitors your hypertension, your weight. So if you have congestive heart failure, if your weight is monitored each day, if it goes up, that's a sign of an intervention might be needed. I'll talk more about that program in a little bit. Rehabilitation services, we offer also have in our Muldoon Clinic, physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and audiology. And we have a neuropsychologist who works with the 673rd Med Group for a traumatic brain injury clinic because we screen our returning soldiers for TBI. And then we have a small prosthetics program also. So here are our sites of care of where we're located in the state. And at the top you can see the Muldoon Clinic, our new Muldoon Clinic, almost 2 years now that we have been there. Behind you can see the 673rd, and we are attached to the 673rd by a link, which allows us access and our patients access to that facility. To the right is the VA-DOD Joint Venture Facility, the 673rd. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. In the bottom of the picture is the Benson and C Street Domiciliary. This is a 50-bed facility for homeless veterans to enter to have almost a year and a half to two-year rehabilitation program. Our next slide up in the left-hand corner shows our community-based outpatient clinic, which is located at the Bassett Army Hospital. Off to the right of that picture is our clinic, entrance to our clinic. Up in the upper left, right-hand corner is a CBOC that we've located in the Matsu. With the right side of that building is our clinic. The Kenai Outpatient Clinic is in the middle. Down in the left-hand corner is the South Peninsula Hospital, where we have a one-day-a-week clinic in that facility. And here in Juneau, we are on the first floor of the federal building for our Juneau Outreach Clinic. So we've placed our clinics, I think if you'll recall back to our population slide, over the last almost 10 years, I guess it would be for these clinics, we've placed our clinics where the people are, where the veterans live. It's a no-brainer, I think, is put these clinics where most of the population is. And when you look at these sites, 89% of all veterans in Alaska live in a borough that has a primary has a service like this with primary care and mental health care. Now that is a huge percentage compared to other states. We all know the challenge is the other 11% that are hundreds of miles, if not 1,000 miles away from some of these sites, and that's what we're working on for rural care.
Ask you a question.
Yes.
Pause for breath. I'll take advantage of it and fill it with a question. Are you pretty much all built up on the clinics you need and the physical facilities, or is there any future construction or future siting you might be looking at?
I don't think there will be any future clinics like this, though we may be able to contract more for like the one-day clinic we have in Homer, looking at some possibilities of some other areas possibly for that. The CBOCs, community-based outpatient clinics, are congressionally funded, and essentially the funding is kind of on hold as they've done these across the country. I think we've placed them in the major population centers here in Alaska. But there may be other types of arrangements in the future. This slide talks about our VA-DOD joint venture with the Air Force. There are 9 joint ventures across the United States between VA and DOD, and we're pretty well recognized as one of the best. We work together. We work well together. We co-manage, the VA and Air Force co-manages the facility. It is an Air Force facility, so the commander is Colonel Tom Harrell of the facility, but we have over 70 FTE, 70 staff that are embedded into the facility. We essentially run the intensive care unit plus other areas. And we have done a lot of joint incentive funds where the VA and DOD put money in together to incentivize working together, and we've utilized that to create a joint sleep lab, to create a sterile processing unit together, to help on MRI CT scans, and actually purchased MRI using those funds. Our latest GIF proposal is that we're working to improve our cardiology services by contributing for in those areas. So the Air Force was best hospital in 2007 in the Air Force system. In 2008, I guess they didn't want to give it in 2009 again, so instead they got the DOD best hospital in the whole DOD system. So that's a first-class system. I know many of you have been out there to see the facility. That is the VA hospital in Alaska. Sometimes I hear folks say, we don't have a VA hospital. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. VA-DOD Joint Venture Hospital. That's the VA hospital.
Any other questions at this point? Or,
yeah. I thought you might be interested in our Operation Enduring Freedom, our Operation Iraqi Freedom, and our Operation New Dawn, as they've changed the names. Our returning soldiers, what have we done in Alaska for our returning soldiers? And since 9/11, we have registered 6,357 returning soldiers that have discharged out of the military and have enrolled in our system. Of those that have enrolled, 2,696, 42% of them are actually receiving care. And those are you can see the sites where they receive that care. For mental health services, 40% of the enrolled veterans are receiving some type of mental health services. Not necessarily all PTSD or traumatic brain injury type services. It could be for marital adjustment, anything. But new substance abuse, 10% are being seen for new substance abuse problems, 60% being seen for combined substance abuse and PTSD. So you often hear in the newspapers about 30% of the returning veterans have problems. Well, the ones that impanel to us, about 39% have mental health issues. For traumatic brain injury of the returning soldiers here to Alaska, 13% test positive for their initial screen, which means they need further screening. In Alaska, we don't see the severely injured traumatic brain injury patients. We do not have the services either in the VA, DOD, or the community for the intensity that's required for that. So those veterans either go to Seattle or Palo Alto for those services. And what we do for our veterans is that they're assigned as they come into our system to one of our patient-aligned care teams. And in that care team, they are assigned a social worker who does a number of screenings on their first visit. Screening for alcohol use, depression, suicide prevention, PTSD, and TBI. And based on that screening, then they will be either case managed by that social worker or referred to a specialty service. And in providing those services. We don't have a delay in any services. We're meeting all the VA standards for access to care for both primary care and our services for our returning soldiers. Eliminating homelessness. This is the Secretary's initiative to eliminate homelessness.
I'm going to back up a second. If somebody screened, a returning veteran that you screened, found out they need treatment for alcohol or substance abuse, do you have your own inpatient, your own facility, or do you refer them to other places in the community?
Most of that care is done on an outpatient basis, but if there's a need for intensive inpatient for depression or PTSD, we'll use the Seattle facility mostly. If there's an acute episode psychiatric need, API is our site that we contract with. Okay. So we do not have inpatient beds for mental health services.
Do you do any referrals for inpatient? Do you do many? You did send them outside?
No. Our average daily census at API for mental health is probably 2.
Okay.
So and so that wouldn't justify our own beds in the 673rd. So eliminating homelessness. Lots has been done for homelessness services, and this has been in, of course, the news lately. And it seems like on all these issues of homeless, rural care, DOD, people in Washington say, where's our most extreme example in the VA system for this? Oh, Alaska. We'll go there and help them. And you know how that is. We get lots of visitors from Washington. They want to come and save us and help us, and then they come out here and they're pretty impressed with what we're already doing. But I've given you lots of information here on a wide variety of programs we're doing for homeless veterans. Compensated work therapy is an example of where we work with employers in town, and we will pay salaries of veterans to gain some skills that then they can go out and gain in independent employment. 60 veterans were involved in that program last year. You see 21 were able to get employment afterwards. Some went to school, some dropped out. Incentive therapy is another program where a small amount of money, incentive therapy, is given to veterans, and usually they work within our VA system. But of those two programs, $301,000 was distributed to veterans in payment for compensated work therapy or incentive therapy.
I got a chance to do this. I was at in San Antonio last summer and saw a program where veterans were working, packaging up flags and mustering out packages. It was kind of like a self-generating thing. It was great.
Yeah, we actually had, at one time we had a contract for packaging, it's like the breadcrumbs on the seafood. A company here, they paid the VA to do the packaging. Mm. And we don't do that any longer, but we look for opportunities like that.
And so what are the other kinds of independent employment in the CWT?
Well, we have veterans that are with the city, with GCI. ANMC has veterans, I know. So we're getting good response. The last bullet on that slide is our residential program, where we own two apartment buildings in Mountain Home and Fairview. And so as a transition from our inpatient domiciliary, a veteran can go to those residential sites and have a place to stay and transition, still get the care they need, the VA care, the mental health care they need, and transition out to their own home or a HUD-VASH voucher. The grant per diem program on our next slide, the VA offers a per diem program to other homeless shelters. Here in Alaska, in Anchorage, a per diem is given to the Salvation Army program. The VA's program isn't for everybody. The Salvation Army program is obviously more religious-based and may attract and be more productive with veterans, so we pay them a per diem for veterans in their program. And up in Fairbanks, the Rescue Mission is another facility that we give a per diem of up to 25 beds a night if they're veterans. One of our biggest programs is this HUD-VASH voucher system, in which we get vouchers to veterans to find rental apartments. And we've exceeded the use of those by 130%. You ask, well, how can that be? Well, as a veteran leaves the program or maybe dies, we reuse that voucher, and so we have the highest utilization actually in our Northwest network. 42 veterans that were housed last year. We have an additional 50 vouchers coming. We work with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on finding homes for these veterans. Our new 50 vouchers that we're going to get, working with HFSC and the Mental Health Trust, we are going to try to expand this to rural areas and contract for case managers. Every one of these veterans is case managed by a social worker or an expert to help them not relapse, have problems.
Good question. Yes, is that a specific dollar amount, or is that 100% of whatever the cost is where they're housed? Or
There is a dollar amount. I have not heard of any, there's certain HUD houses that landlords apply for that they're eligible to receive these vouchers. I have not heard of a problem. Now, as we go out to these rural areas, though, we all know here in Juneau, 2% vacancy rate. Kodiak, 1% vacancy rate. So there's going to be some real challenges finding housing in those kind of markets. And our domiciliary program, I mentioned this 50-bed program, and 80 veterans were discharged last year from that program, 50% success rate. So that's pretty common in to have a recidivism of 50-60%. They have to go through more than once because people relapse.
And how do you measure, what's success measured as, 1 year, 3 years?
It is stability in not being homeless for a six-month period. We also have a supportive services for families grant. $350,000 was awarded to the Catholic Social Services. We can take care of the veteran, but we don't have legal authority to take care of the family. And by partnering with Catholic Social Services, they can bring the family in. So veterans with families that are homeless, they can work with them. And I understand they're going to apply for another $350,000 grant. Mm. And then our supported employment program, these are for veterans that don't have medical problems, don't have mental health problems. They need a job. But they're on the verge of homelessness or they're homeless. And so we've been working with employers, and this is a brand new program just since last July, and we've placed 24 veterans in jobs, and we have 9 right now that it looks like they're going to get jobs also. And so that's been a very successful program. So the bottom line is that, are we ending homelessness? And there are surveys that are done of homeless people across the United States. It's very hard to do a census of homeless. They don't come up and want to be counted, or they're in places where they don't want to be seen. And the HUD does a point-in-time survey, which is the official homeless survey across the United States. And here in Alaska, in the last 2 years, those people surveyed who self-identified themselves as veterans has decreased by 49%. So it is some data that indicates that we are making progress on ending homelessness for veterans, and we'll keep going with these programs.
And does that rate compare favorably or unfavorably with outside?
It's better than some other areas, across the United States, there is a downward trend on veterans being homeless.
And actually, with the committee's indulgence, there's a proposal for the Vets Village in Chugach Eagle River area. Do you know anything about this? Do you have a position on it?
I don't have a position. I've heard that there's some interest in that. We have been working with the Carlick Manor, mm-hmm. Which is a Housing First initiative, and with the Tanana House, I believe it's called, up in Fairbanks, that has just opened. And a Housing First effort is to get homeless into a safe environment. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a requirement of sobriety for a certain amount of time. It's get them into a safe house. In the Carlick Manor in Anchorage, I think we have 2 veterans that are in the program who have shopped there, and we're working with the Tanana House as they open up to have veterans use that too.
How far along is that there in Fairbanks? Is it open yet, or are they still working on the...
I think it may open this week.
This week?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. I'll be home next week.
All right. Rural health care is a very... lots of interest in reaching out to veterans in rural areas, and we have a lot of Alaska Native veterans that we are working with the tribal system in order to identify how we can work better together. There nationally is a VA-IHS MOU regarding working together. And when the secretary came last year, he figured out real quick Alaska was different. And he said, we need a separate work group just for working with Alaska issues. And so we created that work group, and I've been meeting with tribal leaders in healthcare about how we can work together to get veterans more care. There's 3 areas that we've focused on. One is increasing access to the VA system, get people enrolled. And we have a very successful program called the Tribal Veteran Representative Program, where we have taken trusted members of a tribe, sponsored by their tribe, and train them in basic eligibility, how to get people enrolled, who do you call if you need services. We have 40 current tribal veteran representatives across Alaska. We have a training coming up in 2 weeks for 40 more, and then we'll do another one in the fall. So we hope to have 100 tribal veteran representatives across Alaska by the end of the year.
So are the TVRs trained to a higher standard than a VSO?
No. VSOs are certified and go through a certification process. They are not trained to that level, but they are trained of how to get a hold of a VSO if they need one. And what we have learned from this experience is when we used to go out to villages and say, we're from the VA, we're here to help, maybe 10 people would show up. Now when we go out, we have our tribal veteran representative sponsor us. And I think when we went to Barrow, we had 10 people a couple years ago. And this time we had 400 people. We signed up 50 veterans and a potlatch and dancing and, of course, everything that was sponsored by our TVR up there. So that is a win, I think. And we've received money from the Office of Rural Health, another tactic. We are actually going out very soon for a contract with tribal organizations to give them money to redesign their intake process to assure they ask for if a person is a veteran and how to get them enrolled at the time they enroll in their service. And as many of you realize, Alaska Natives, they don't sign up for Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE. So whatever system they develop for veterans, I think, will also enhance the ability at the same time to go down that list and try to get other benefits for our Alaska Natives. Our second tactic is to improve the coordination of care, and we have been working with some of the tribal organizations and signing an MOU that agrees that we agree that we agree to work together to get them the care they need. And so far, we've signed an agreement with Ketchikan and Metlakatla. Kotzebue is soon going to happen, and I think it's symbolic. It says that the tribal organization trusts the VA. We trust them, and here are our responsibilities of how we're going to work together. So I think it's important to sign these.
And to co-manage in what areas?
Co-manage the health care. That if a veteran is being seen in their health care system but has needs that can be met by the VA system, that we will share health care information, that we will work with their providers, they'll work with our providers, and assure that all the health care needs are being met, whichever system the veteran chooses to use.
And that pretty much, that's pretty small communities. You're looking to expand that to other communities?
Yes. Well, yes, I think Kotzebue and Nome will come along next. And Search, for that matter.
Now, last year I was out in a village called Kakanak on the lake in Penn area, and there was some Coast Guard, National Guard personnel that were wandering around talking, looking for veterans and stuff like that. Are you guys involved with the National Guard in trying to reach out?
Yes, we're very involved in the talk. I have a slide on that, doing some more outreach with the partnership of the state of Alaska, with TRICARE, and the VA and DOD, and we have teams that about 5-6 years ago went to 120 villages, and we are going to be going out again with the return of the 425 from Fairbanks and the deployed National Guard members that are currently deployed, about 147 that are deployed right now, actually in harm's way, when they return to be prepared with mental health services. So we're doing that same thing. Our last tactic is to look at sharing agreements, a template that we can agree to use. It's not mandatory, but if we come to an agreement with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium members of a template that would fit most of our situations with most of our tribes in Alaska, you know we have half the tribes in the United States are located in Alaska, and there are no IHS facilities here, so therefore we have to do a consultation process with each individual tribe. But I think they're actually meeting this week on this template, and so we're making progress there.
Meeting tomorrow.
The lots of activities in rural initiatives. This is a program, Care Closer to Home, that I really wanted to share with you. It started with the congressional interest of our senators about sending veterans to Seattle for care. And in 2008, as an example, 750 veterans went to Seattle for care. And so through their interest, through veterans' concerns, and through our leadership and our advocacy, because every time I had a visitor from Washington or somewhere else and said, they said, "What keeps you up at night?" I said, "Sending veterans 1,500 miles for care. It's just not right." And our Secretary for Operations came in May of 2010, and especially I was concerned about our oncology patients, to go down there for chemotherapy and feel sick and have to get on an airplane and come back. And we told him about that, and he said, "Why don't you, I want you to keep oncology care here in Alaska." And so we moved quickly to make that happen in May, and then when the Secretary came up in May of 2011, at the request and sponsorship of Senator Begich, he figured it out quick, and he says, "I want you to keep more care here as much as you can in Alaska." And so Alaska congressional invitations work, as you know. Bringing Washington people to Alaska to see it, it needs to be done, and as a result, we are now keeping more care at home. So our oncology care back in May 2010, since that time, 221 oncology patients have stayed in Alaska that in the past we would have sent to Puget Sound for care. And the, of course, the families love it.
I'm assuming that's a net savings to the VA, I'm going to assume.
Actually, it's not, because the cost of care in at the Puget Sound VA is less than care that is purchased in the community, and the high cost of care in Alaska especially. And so it's an increase in the cost for us. And so July of 2011, we expanded that to other specialty care. And you can see the numbers and the decrease in numbers of veterans that we've sent down to the lower 48 for care. But so far in 2012, we're on pace to exceed what we sent last year. Well, why is that? Well, if you remember, I told you we're growing at 5% and 6% a year in veterans. Older veterans are being seen. More older veterans are being seen to have care. The word is out. You don't have to travel to Seattle, so we have more veterans coming in to see us.
No, I don't.
So, but we still do send some veterans. We offer Seattle for care, and this slide tells you what type of veterans those are. Surgery patients, post-surgical cases, maybe they got their surgery down in Puget Sound, and therefore they need to come back for their yearly checkup or something. Highly complex cases are still referred. Continuity of care, they may have a doctor down there that they've seen in past years, they want to continue with that doctor. There's certain care that's not available in Alaska that we can't purchase in Alaska. Spinal cord injury, trauma, transplants are areas that we don't have in Alaska. We still support our education mission in the University of Washington cardiothoracic program, so we send our heart cases. We basically have a conversation with the veteran. Do you wish to get your care locally, or do you want to go to the lower 48? And many veterans still want to go to lower 48. Maybe there's family down there they would prefer to. I know many of us have friends that get their care in Seattle when they get some tragedy. They prefer to go to Seattle and not get their care. So we still send some veterans to Seattle. So here's a list of the types of cases that we've put into the community so far this year that in the past we would have sent to Seattle. Now, remember I told you, I told the visitors years ago that what kept me up at night was sending somebody 1,500 miles to get care. And now what keeps me up at night is how I'm going to pay for keeping this. So I'm still up at night, if you want to call me at 3 a.m., thinking about care in our community. And some of these specialties you can see are big ticket items for cost. So I'm still working with central office on how we're going to sustain this. There could be nothing worse that could happen than 3 years from now, 4 years from now, say, "Well, we don't have enough money. We're going to have to stop doing this."
Mr. Osterman?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, is that number for orthopedic, is that because of the lack of care here, or is it because of better care down there?
No, this is going into our community here. And so those are 152 cases that have been referred to orthopedic surgeons in Alaska.
And are those mostly Anchorage, or the
most of your specialty care is in Anchorage. Some in Fairbanks, Central Peninsula, and Kenai has now expanded a little bit of care. But if the specialty care is provided locally at those hospitals, we will refer the patient there. Now, we do look at the treatment plan and review it and approve it. We do. We're looking for quality standards. We cannot support research. We don't have the authority to pay for research. Non-FDA approved procedures, we cannot pay for those either. So it is reviewed. It's not 100%. There's a review and a discussion that goes on with the providing doctor.
Just back to this might be an opportune time to say a few words about the Fisher House. Just to let people know what it is we're talking about, referring people to
care. That's great.
Alaska.
I'm glad you brought that up. I need to get the picture of the new Fisher House and put it in our presentation. The Fisher House has opened. The Fisher House is like a Ronald McDonald House for active duty and veteran families. And here in Alaska, we just a couple of weeks ago cut the ribbon on a Fisher House, which is on the Elmendorf campus, on the 673rd campus. It is open. It is an Alaska Fisher House, so it is veterans. Families and veterans are eligible. Active duty and active duty families are eligible. Coast Guard, it's 12 beds, and they will consider building a second story to it if we fill up those 12 beds, which I think we will. So just gotten started and using it. Veterans, families have used it. The day that Representative Sadler was there was a family that had come from Eielson, who had a premature baby that was in Providence Hospital, and they were staying in the Fisher House free. There's no charge while their baby got better to take home. So it's a wonderful story. It's from the Fisher Foundation, and they've built these homes all over the United States and actually in Europe, and the next one's going to be in England for the soldiers and their families. Thanks for asking. I want to talk very quickly, I'm almost finished, on our health information exchange. This is a program that I represent the VA and DOD on the board of directors for the Alaska eHealth Network, and this is the ability to create an exchange system in Alaska where all medical records can be shared between providers. And so the purpose is having this electronic record shared to improve patient safety, to decrease costs. You may hear something about this in the legislature. There was money that came through from the feds through the state down to the Alaska eHealth Network for this, and we're working to figure out sustainability. It will save money. It'll save money for Medicaid greatly if you don't have to duplicate tests and you have the information right there handy. Duplicate tests. Things like this. So just want to let you know that we're participating with the private sector in creating this in Alaska. And I think it will be a big boon for healthcare.
Is every provider in Alaska bound to, or this is an optional thing to sign up for?
It's optional, but there's incentives to join. You know, there's 2,000 providers, doctors in Alaska. That's not very many. And there's several major hospitals, Fairbanks, Providence, Alaska Regional, then you have Bartlett, then you have your smaller hospitals, and then you have the tribal system. So if we can't figure out a way to connect all of us, the annual cost of running this is like $2.5 million. That's not much to have access to every health record, man, woman, and child. So you may hear more about this as it rolls out, and I want to let you know the feds are working with the state, with the commissioner, and with the private sector to make this happen.
Senator Thompson?
Thank you. With the HIPAA laws, expanding it out to Native health organizations and all of the public doctors besides on base items, it must be a pretty secure system?
Yes. There are the highest standards of security are the military standards, and so everything is built to that standard. I think there probably are concerns of some citizens about their health information right. being exchanged. So it requires the patient to opt in, to sign and agree to this, and they will have that opportunity.
I was going to ask, does that, Mr. Representative Hausherman, your question?
Oh, right.
Does that include the records kept? Is it every visit to provider? Is it down to the level of prescription drugs and therapies, or is it just basic information about them?
What it will do is it will go out. You have to have an electronic record, obviously, in order. In most of your facilities and private doctor's offices are moving in that direction. But it goes out and grabs certain information into a summary. And then if you are a facility that your patient has said, I'm in the eHealth network, you can go out and grab that information, and you get a patient summary of medications, problems, lab test results, summary results of visits.
I confess, my wife actually is a programmer for Indian Health Service, and she does electronic health records. So, and she's very, very secret about it. So, what's that about to
On a separate subject.
Sure. Go.
And it's just a curiosity question for me. Alaska VA healthcare system, and so in Alaska, the National Guard, which guys normally serve 7 to 10 years, something in that neighborhood. And if they don't go out and do active duty service, are they part of the VA system at all?
No, they are not. So they have to be activated and deployed in a war zone, essentially. So I think that concludes my presentation. Verdi Bowen is here, and Verdi just signed an agreement at the national level as the State Veterans Affairs Coordinator with the Secretary of the VA, talking about the VA and the state working together. And we've always worked together, and Verdi has the service officers under him to help us. We work with the service officers. What we try to do is, I've given you a brief outline of what the federal system does. And in working with Verdi, we try to look where the gaps are. Where are the gaps in that the state might want to step in and help? And I thought I had a slide in here about our outreach efforts. You mentioned that earlier, but we are with the returning soldiers in 9 months to a year, we are working with TriWest, which is the TRICARE managed care contractor, with the state of Alaska, the National Guard, and all of our federal partners to do an outreach, and we're going to focus on suicide prevention. We know the soldiers will come home, and some of them will have problems, especially those that were in harm's way. And we want to work with the families and provide them the support before the soldiers get home. And so we're right now doing an assessment, all the organizations, we're doing an assessment of what the needs are, and we'll produce a plan, and then we will go and share the responsibility of visiting villages and areas to provide training to the mental health providers, to the schools, to the religious religious community also, because oftentimes schools and church see symptoms of problems with the family and the kids that reflect that there may be problems at home before the family steps forward. And so we want to do that before the soldiers return.
Representative Thomas has a question.
Yeah, you kind of covered part of it there. I was mayor in Fairbanks back in 2001 to 2007, and we had the first large deployment off of Fort Wainwright. When they returned, one of the big concerns was domestic violence. You know, they've been over there for so long, and so are they doing screening or anything prior to them coming back into the family family fold and the family atmosphere? I know that's a huge concern because of what they've been through, and they come back and have to readjust.
I think there's several screenings that are done. There's several screenings done by the military with the National Guard, and then when they become veterans, you saw the four areas we screen them in: alcohol use, PTSD, and suicide prevention, TBI. All those areas lend themselves to domestic abuse, and so yes, they're screening to try to catch that before an event would happen.
A suicide prevention task force. Is the VA represented in that?
I think so. I'd have
council,
to double
council.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Lynn, your question?
I don't know quite how to frame the question, I'll start backwards first, I guess. It's my experience in Vietnam that as far as behavior there and after they got out, that the good got better and the bad got worse. If you had your act together before you went to Vietnam, you had your act doubly better when you got back. If you were a marginal case, when you went there, for however you wanted to define that, when you came back, it was eight times worse. So it exaggerated the good and exaggerated the bad. Very few people went over there and remained the same. And I don't know how you would measure that, going in, unless you did some kind of mental screen before you went in and see what the condition was when they came out. But to me and several of my fellow Vietnam veterans, we talk about that. You sometimes you see, and hope I don't make problems here, but sometimes, there are all kinds of Vietnam veterans in all different varieties. Sometimes when you go to a ceremony or you see a Vietnam veteran pictured someplace, you see the fellow with a raggedy shirt, a turban around their head, kind of a tough hippie, if you will. But most of the Vietnam veterans, if they wore a suit and tie before they went away, they wear a suit and tie when they come back. It is an exaggerated thing. I wonder about our new veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and et cetera, if that's the same thing. But nobody ever comes back the same.
Well, actually, I think about 2 years ago, the DOD started doing pre-deployment screening along the line you're talking about, with mental health screening and other types of screening. I think it's for research, and I haven't seen any published results. Would kind of be data along what you're talking about. If you had a predisposition to depression before you went in, and do you have it afterwards? Do you aggravate it?
Yeah.
And if you don't, and you come out and you don't have those problems, so maybe we'll see some data on that. It is hard to measure. You're correct. And again, we're, as a healthcare system, we're seeing veterans that are in need. The veterans that have adjusted well don't come to us. And you saw in the figures of mental health services, there were 40% of the people that do come to us had a mental health need of one kind or another, which, again, supports, I think, some of the data we've seen of, I've seen 30% of the soldiers returning have some mental health issues. So of those that do seek care, 40% needed some sort of mental health intervention.
I know that now we have a volunteer military force, whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but there's a different demographic going in the military now than we had during World War II, Korea, and some of the draft in Vietnam. So the everybody's a volunteer, is that a different demographic as far as mental health is concerned than those who were dragged in whether they wanted to be or not? You have a much broader representation of people when there's a draft than you do when it's volunteer.
I have not seen any data about that. Be interesting question, though.
Representative Thompson?
Thank you. Kind of a follow-up from my earlier question. We were talking about watching what the military that are returning. When I was mayor, we knew that we had a large amount of returning from one deployment, and I brought the base commander from Fort Wainwright, and I had my police department. We had them all trained into sensitivity that, there's going to be some of these people that are going to react differently when they come back. They aren't criminals. Are you working in Anchorage with that type of thing when you have a large deployment returning, where you work with the community so that they can work with the sensitivity of what's going on and try to get them help instead of treating them like criminals?
We have reached out to police, the village police also, to talk about PTSD and some of the signs and symptoms. Our suicide prevention folks have worked with the police departments. That you mention it now, maybe it's time to go back and do that again. It's been a few years, so thank you for bringing that up. And just talking about, startle reflexes from the war, things like this, might be indications of how to talk to a veteran in a difficult situation that the police have. So I will look into that.
Thank you.
I've got to make a pitch. There's legislation pending that would put a veteran's designation on a driver's license, which might help provide some early warning to a traffic stop situation. So couldn't help myself, sir. Sorry. Good question?
No, comments I'm not going to make.
I got another question for you. We're hearing a lot about the prospect of the Defense Department budget cuts, and I don't know if that you've got any heads up as to any potential budget cuts to the VA or health care services for veterans. If you have, what have we heard, and what, how can you prepare for that?
Well, that would be at the national level, but I have not gotten information about any concrete information about budget cuts for 13 or 14.
Any rumors, gossip, innuendo?
I don't deal in rumors, gossip, and innuendo when I testify.
I got a couple, just other couple questions. You've laid out a very good system, looks like, very complete, but there's nothing's perfect. Are there any holes that you think need filling or other areas need to be addressed in providing health care services to veterans?
Well, I think that we offer a wide range of services. I'm sure there's more we could do. I think there's here in Alaska we have the unique issue of distance in the rural area. It's a real challenge making sure that veterans in rural areas, frontier areas in Alaska, get everything they're entitled to because of the distance. We can't be everywhere. I guess some of our travel issues as a result of being Alaska and being unique in that area, the travel budget is stretched to allow these outreach programs that we've talked about. You can only do so much and with the money you're given, and have to judge we're going to go to these five places this year. Next year we'll go to another five. When people say, why haven't you been to Igigik? And we say, well, we're glad to put you on the list and see if we can come out there. So those are challenges.
We'd actually spoken before the meeting about the initiatives to allow veterans to get service at tribal clinics, and we talked about that a little bit here too. I'm going to ask, is there any advice you might give to veterans or anybody who deals with veteran services who might be listening or watching, I guess? What message would you want to send to them?
Well, enrollment is the key, and so get veterans enrolled in the VA system. And even veterans that have insurance or have another source, I say enroll. We oftentimes encounter veterans that say, I don't need to enroll in your VA system, I have private health insurance. And then they have a tragedy, a tragic disease or heart attack or something, and then they have a co-payment of $400,000 and they come to us and say, could you pay this bill? And it's, we can't because you never enrolled in the system. So get people to the service officers. They have the knowledge of your Military Order of the Purple Heart, your VFW, your Disabled American Veterans, your American Legion service officers. They are located in our building in Muldoon if you want to come there, but there are other sources you can go to that will help you enroll for your benefits.
Or the TVRs you spoke of.
And the TVRs have been wonderful in that area.
Any other questions from the committee? Good deal. Mr. Spector, I really appreciate coming all the way to Snowy Juneau to give the presentation. I'm pleased to hear all the multifaceted system you've got delivering services across a wild land, a big land, so thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much for having me. I'll be glad to come back anytime.
And thanks to Bertie Bowen for being here as well. Did you have to go to your lifeline behind you? In terms of housekeeping business, actually there's not going to be a meeting next week. There's going to be some folks taking off to do duty back in D.C. and some folks elsewhere. So we will, I guess, wrap up business for this week and next week. It is now 2:12 p.m. and we are adjourned.